from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Historically, changes to worship have always caused intense reaction. Pope Francis's decree limiting the use of the traditional Latin Mass is no different. On Register Radio, Monsignor Charles Pope helps us sift through the concerns and frustrations many Catholics have expressed. Then, in an editor's corner, Matthew Bunsen, executive editor for EWTN News, and I discuss a roundup of Catholic news. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, your host here on Register Radio. Matthew Bunsen joins us from the Napa Institute, where Catholic lay leaders, priests, religious, and bishops gather in what seems kin to an intellectual and spiritual retreat. Welcome, Matthew.
Good morning. Very good to be with you.
But first, we have some important news to discuss, the biggest news of the week, and that is Pope Francis's motu proprio called Traditionis Custodes, or Guardians of Tradition in English. For many, the Pope's decision to restrict what has been called the extraordinary form of the Mass, or the traditional Latin Mass, has been a bombshell. There's been so much heat around this, and my hope today is to bring some clarity, calm, and maybe even more understanding, even if there's disappointment. I hope and I think that Monsignor Pope can help us with that. But Matthew, before we get into, we're joined by Monsignor Pope, can you provide us a summary of what the Pope's motu proprio does?
Yeah, you mentioned that the title is Guardians of Tradition, and there are some who would consider the title to be somewhat ironic in the sense that what the Holy Father is essentially doing is rolling back two important documents, one under Pope St. John Paul II and the other under Pope Benedict XVI. The second one, Summorum Pontificum of 2007, really expanded the access to the extraordinary form of the traditional Latin Mass, especially giving priests much more latitude in when they can say the Latin Mass and for the faithful who wanted it. What Pope Francis is doing is essentially shifting almost all authority over the traditional Latin Mass to the bishops of the world. They're the ones who are going to have the authority to decide when and where it's going to be said. But even there, Rome still is going to be weighing in. For example, if you have a newly ordained priest who wants to learn and say the extraordinary form, he has to go to the bishop for permission, and then the bishop himself has to, quote, consult with Rome before he can actually authorize it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of effort clearly being put in here to restrict the extraordinary form. Part of it, as Pope Francis says, is because of the concern that divisions might be caused in the church by the adherence of this. Now, that's obviously a very controversial take for a lot of supporters and adherents.
That's right. That's right. Well, that wonderful nutshell there of a bombshell. So thank you, Matthew. Monsignor Pope is a pastor at a parish within the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., and he writes a daily blog at the Archdiocese of Washington's website. And of course, he's a regular contributor at ncregister.com, where his most recent post was a cry from the heart about Traditionis Custodes and the Latin Mass. Monsignor Pope, you are a pastor at a parish in D.C. Where the extraordinary form, let's say the ordinary form of the Mass is the usual Mass celebrated at daily and weekly worship. But you also regularly celebrate the extraordinary form, that is the Latin Mass. In your experience, why do some Catholics prefer the older rite of the Mass?
You know, I think there is something that does surprise me about that. I am not entirely sure why, but I think there's something fundamentally regarding the aesthetic of it. It's quiet. It's very different from the world. Less busy, less noisy. These are some of the things that they say, and it's generally that quiet, sort of ancient aesthetic that I think most appeals. But it clearly, there is also a sense, I think, and if you want to just be a little more theological, is that somehow God is other. And this is, I think, what a lot of them find in the ancient liturgy, that there's something, we're going before God who is not like this world.
Very true. And I think some people have also expressed the desire for that continuity for centuries, that this was the Mass that was celebrated by the Universal Church. And you know, people have cited to me, so many saints have celebrated in this liturgy, that there's just a connection with the, mm-hmm. with the past and the present, that they sense, aside from that sacredness, you know, stepping out of the world and finding something different in the way mm-hmm. we worship. That's what some have expressed to us. And you write about in your column that I mentioned in the introduction, you write about 10 parishes within the Archdiocese there in Washington, D.C. Have the traditional Latin Mass. Is that a growth from previous years? Is that a recent development that so many parishes are celebrating?
Yeah, it is. It's grown. We originally had four parishes that were sort of designated in those days before the Summorum Pontificum motu proprio. There was a limit to where masses could be celebrated in that form. But with the lifting of it, and the fact that many young people, along with younger priests, have interest, that this has been kind of a growth. And they're more informal in the sense that the celebrations, in that they're not always the fundamentally big Sunday morning Mass. Sometimes mm-hmm. they're more privately. So, for example, in my own parish, I have a Thursday evening Mass in the old form. And it's just my day off, and I celebrate that form, and some have come to join me over the years.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. So it sounds to me, and I think you did clarify this in your column, that it's not there's not a parish dedicated to the traditional Latin Mass in the Archdiocese of Washington, but it's happening at communities that also celebrate or primarily celebrate the Novus Ordo, as some say, or the newer Mass, the ordinary Mass. It sounds like that is a very peaceful situation. It doesn't seem to be what Pope Francis has described as concerning him, where there are divisions surrounding the two forms of the Mass. I've seen, actually, some of those divisions here in my local archdiocese, where, you know, some parishes have sort of separated, or a group of people have separated from another parish, and there's tension. I definitely have seen that tension and some concern over it, but that the Archdiocese was allowing it to go forward and to create, they were in the process of becoming another parish, but certainly I've seen some anxiety over it. What do you make of the claim that the Pope has, what he has seen as a division?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to know who his advisors are, but I will say, let's all stipulate, I think there have been, in the blogosphere and other forums, you know, there is a group of maybe hot-headed folks who I think foment a lot of triumphalism with the old Mass, and also a kind of a disdain for the new Mass, and also the Second Vatican Council. This does go on. But I do think that we have to be fair, it's a small number in the traditionalist movement. Most of them are just families and folks who like to come. Most of the people who come to my Masses here also go to the new Mass. They're not a separatist group. This is just something that we do in the parish occasionally for those who love that form. And we all get along fine. There's also a lot of our parishes I mentioned in the article who have like the neocatechumenal way, and that has significant liturgical and sort of separatist qualities. Mm-hmm. But there's also Eastern rites that are celebrated in some of our parishes, and we all kind of make room for each other. And I think that's more the American experience. I don't know where the Pope's getting his information, but the blogosphere is not usually the best place, or Twitter, to understand what's really going on.
Right, and that is very true. I think that is part of what has caused the most concern from my perspective. I'm one who attends the ordinary form of the Mass. I think it is beautiful, the extraordinary form. Sometimes the ordinary form in Latin is just as beautiful as well. Mm-hmm. But I have been concerned, too, about some of what you see in the blogosphere over attacks on Vatican II and a lot of people starting to question Vatican II even more and more. And of course, that was an element of the Pope's decree. And yet it seems like there could have been another way to respond to this division that maybe is forming. Monsignor, you write about your own disappointment, your frustrations. I think that you echo a lot of what I have heard from many people, many, many people. What are some of the biggest concerns that you have over the way that this was done and how it is being received?
Yeah, well, I think it's basically his heavy-handed tone, very kind of dour, restrictive. The Pope uses language, you know, that's very harsh in places, you know. I make a firm decision, you know, he says, to abrogate, you know, and all the permissions and customs that precede this present motu proprio. You know, he wants them to take place immediately, and he expects the bishops to cooperate with him in this and apply these norms exactly, even though some of the norms are hard to know. How could you apply them? I mean, there's ambiguities. So, yeah, it's a combination of being a little ambiguous in places, but very heavy in sense of its legal binding obligations. And I've never heard him speak any other way like this, you know, to any other groups that, frankly, are far more, I think, concerning than people who go to Latin Mass.
That's right.
The Holy Father has stressed unity as one of the keys to the reasoning for this motu proprio. But it seems that we're already seeing a real divergence among different bishops and dioceses now as to how readily accessible the Mass is going to be. In some places, we're seeing it heavily restricted. So is this going to achieve the kind of unity that the Holy Father is hoping?
Well, I think not. And I'll say the driving people to the margins, in effect saying to them, you know, you're not welcome in our parish churches, because it's puzzling, but he says that the bishop is to assign places for people attached to this form, but it's not to be a parish church. He's not to erect any new personal parish. Well, where are they supposed to go? Mm. I mean, this is, of course, puts a lot of pressure on the bishop. Well, what am I supposed to do? I mean, how do I take care of these people? So I think that it further the divisions in the sense that it says to a group who, you know, you're in effect not welcome in our parishes, and that's hurtful, first of all, and that's how it's perceived anyway. And it's also not just hurtful, but then this is the kind of thing that says, well, okay, and then that drives him into the arms of maybe more extremist groups like the SSPX and others that are really off, not just in the margins, but in some sense are, you know, actively you know, separated from the local bishop. And I think it's going to backfire, and I think that it's a hurtfulness and heavy-handedness. And the fact, as you mentioned earlier, Matthew, it sort of gives the bishop authority, but then ties his hands. And so I can't imagine that even a lot of bishops are oh, thanks for the headache. You know, I've got an impossible situation, you create. Now, again, I can't speak for the bishops. I'm very grateful, though, that many bishops have, in fact, said, well, look, we need to study this more and try to get to the bottom of some of the questionable details. I mean, questionable in the sense of hard to understand, and we need to study this and really, you know, pastorally implement this, and God bless them, because, you know, that's the pastor talking, you see. And I think pastors say, well, look, I gotta tie up some unity here a little more, but I just simply saying to one group, you go away, isn't usually the way to do it.
That's right. And I think you're right about the bishops kind of taking it in, but not acting in a reactionary way. Matthew mentioned there are some who have reacted quite swiftly to, you know, put an end or maybe very restrictive in their diocese, but most in a survey in the, you know, I would say a soft survey we've taken in just monitoring the responses. In the U.S., they've mostly said, okay, status quo, you know, those who had permission, we will grant permission for the most part, and yet we'll study how this is to be implemented. I think you've said something that's so important, and that's, you know, the pastor's response, the response of a shepherd. Monsignor Gerhard Mueller wrote at the Catholic Thing that this was like being hit over the head with a shepherd's crook, you know, for many. And yet he also acknowledges that wherever there has been, let's say, a rejection of the ordinary form amongst those who prefer or who attend the Latin Mass, or a rejection of Vatican II, those needed a course correction. Those people needed to be pulled in with the shepherd's crook, you know, not hit over the head. And I thought he had an excellent commentary there at the Catholic Thing. But what do you say for those who are heartbroken right now and feel really concerned over the actions of our shepherd, you know, for the whole church? How do you advise them? How do you speak to them as part of your flock, too?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, to say that many share the heartbreak. So for those who feel heartbroken, or sometimes the anger that comes after being heartbroken, please know many are with you, and many of our bishops also understand that. So let's stay together, let's work together. There are concerns that the Holy Father raises about better unity. He is to some degree responding to a lot of the stuff that goes on the internet. So let's really work hard in our parishes to love one another, to make room in each other's hearts for one another. As any pastor, like I have lots of issues in my parish, and not just about liturgy, but I've got a lot of new younger people joining the parish, from the neighborhoods are changing, and there's racial and age dynamics. But what can I do as a pastor to bring all of us together so that we regard one another with mutual respect and patience is, I think, a task that's always going on in the church. And so I think from our side, I say, for those of us who love the traditional Mass, we can say, well, look, we do need to be taught in this, and help us. Don't drive us to the margins, but help us to know how we can be a better part of a parish life if that's perceived as a problem.
And Monsignor, on the flip side of that, for those, and I know people who have been concerned over family members that they don't quite understand their attachment to the traditional Mass, and they are worried about their anger, you know, or whatnot. How can those friends and family understand better and even encourage their fellow parishioners and family?
Yeah, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day who said, you know, he hadn't ever gone to a traditional Mass until about a few years ago. But when he walked in, he was expecting all these kind of sour-faced saints, and, you know. But he found a joyful parish that was a joyful group of parishioners who were actually quite happy to see him.
Yeah.
And they didn't immediately come and say, what is your position on, you know. I said, most Catholics, so a little bit of understanding is that there's a kind of a demonizing or image that I think has to be overcome. Most people who go to the traditional Mass, they're parents with kids, and they're just normal Catholics, and they may have strong preferences about liturgy, but a lot of people do. I think the bigger point is they're good normal people. They're good Catholics, and we've got a Pope who wants to be very, very tolerant and go to the margins about many who, you know, are actually trying to change moral and doctrines of the Church, and with them he's very patient. So I think mutual patience, I think, is the kind of thing. So there's also, I think, among traditional Catholics, a perceived imparity or and how the Pope treats certain groups and other groups. And so I think all of that anger needs to be brought together, acknowledged, but also work with your pastor and your bishop. What can we do? Because the Pope's concern isn't just out of nowhere.
Right, I agree. And you know what comes to mind as you were speaking is the story of the prodigal son, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you speak of, you know, maybe those who are very much on the fringes of doctrine and who are not accepting the church and in her teachings, they seem to be the prodigal son, right? And they're not even turned around to come home yet, perhaps, but the Pope is going after them. And yet those who attend the traditional Latin Mass are often like the older brother, who is frustrated over that outreach that the Pope might have. But there's something to be learned, a softening of heart, even in the older son, in that story of the prodigal son. So I think your words remind me of that, and maybe it's something for all of us to reflect on.
Yeah, amen.
Well, Monsignor, thank you so much for your time today and for writing at ncregister.com. I invite our listeners to read your column, A Cry from the Heart About Tradiciones Custodis and the Latin Mass. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We will be talking, Matthew and I, about Napa Institute, which is basically a prayer, a retreat, an intellectual retreat, and a hope for going forward in this crazy world that we're living in. We'll talk more about that on the next segment of Register Radio here on EWTN. Stay tuned for more.
In these uncertain times, Catholics depend on EWTN's National Catholic Register. The Register is so much more than a newspaper. It's your faith, your life, your source of information and spiritual resources. The Register is uplifting, redemptive journalism, interviews with Catholic leaders and newsmakers, liturgical coverage, health, financial, and political topics, and analysis of the key issues you care most about. EWTN's National Catholic Register covers every aspect of the Catholic faith that impacts your world. To get 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. That's ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, my co-host here on Register Radio. Matthew, you're in Napa.
I am. Napa, California. It's a pretty corner of the world, that's for certain.
Yes, I've never been. I wish I was there at the Napa Institute's annual conference. It's looking over the schedule and making the decision to send Joan Frawley Desmond there, who I'm sure will have some reports next week. I was just looking, wow, what an opportunity to rest and kind of grow in community, worship together, and also exercise the mind, right, in formation.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the prayer side is especially important here. I think there's about a mass every half hour, because we have a lot of priests here and many opportunities for the rosary, many opportunities for spiritual direction, confession, obviously. So you're absolutely right that prayer is one of those pillars for this. As the Institute itself says, there are the three pillars of community formation and liturgy.
Wonderful. And I said it, there's time to rest, but there's also quite a few people there and many, many talks to attend. So maybe it's not quite a rest of the body, but maybe a rest of the spirit. What are some of the highlights of the talks and the sessions and the roundtables you've been able to attend?
Well, one of the big things here is that capacity, the ability to just meet other Catholic leaders from such a variety of apostolates, everyone from Curtis Martin to Chris Stefanik, and sort of the ringleader of all of this, the ringmaster, is Father Robert Spitzer, who's very well known, of course, to our audience as the host of Father Spitzer's Universe. But he's one of those people, I think, who can articulate such complicated problems that we're facing in the world today in such a beautiful manner. And then we have a number of speakers, such as Archbishop Chaput, Tim Gray from the Augustine Institute, looking at the pressing questions of our time. There's going to be a special panel on Traditionis Custodes. I believe Archbishop Chaput is going to be on it, Archbishop Cordiglione, where they have a chance to reflect within sort of this setting about the Holy Father's motu proprio. But then we've had panels on innovation, and we've had panels on what Christ suffered by Dr. Thomas McGovern from the Catholic Medical Association. So it really runs the gamut. And there are so many myths that I know are perpetuated in some corners of certainly progressive Catholic media about what happens here and what they talk about. And I can tell you, from the very start of this, the stress has always been put that we love the Holy Father, and that it's important to look at the Holy Father and what he's trying to teach us.
Right, right. You know, I mean, talking with Monsignor Pope in the last segment, you know, just about the disappointment, but about the needs to understand one another, to really get to know where the other's point of view is. This is this opportunity maybe to be with like kind, but it certainly is the opportunity to form one's mind so that you can articulate well and in a peaceful and calm way, you know, the point of view. And I think Napa Institute is really helpful for that, because they are measured and they're deep. And so here's a chance for our audience to check out what's there. It's Napa-Institute.org, and usually after a time they make the talks available for the general audience. But speaking of California, Matthew, we said this was going to be an editor's corner, and speaking of California, this week House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of Democrat of California cited her Catholic faith while also defending efforts to permit federal funding of elective abortions. I mean, whoa. Well, her bishop, Archbishop Corleone, responded. What did he have to say?
Well, that's right. This is not the first, and I suspect nor will it be the last time that Speaker Pelosi weighs in trying to provide cover for her support of abortion, the declaration that she's a devout Catholic. She makes the argument, for example, that she's had five children, I believe, and so she is doing all of this and an issue of fairness and things. Archbishop Guadaglione, who has also been very firm in the past with Speaker Pelosi, said it very bluntly. He said, "Let me repeat, no one can claim to be a devout Catholic and condone the killing of innocent human life, let alone have the government pay for it." And of course, what he's referring to is this effort to expand Medicare, and then also to strip the Hyde Amendment from the new budget, something that another Catholic president, Joe Biden, has been trying to do as well in his budget. So we're seeing, emerging out of this House Appropriations Committee, a real effort, an aggressive effort to expand abortion on almost every front in the country. And the tip of the spear for this is Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who, as we're just saying, as a self-proclaimed Catholic.
Right, right. And another news item from Washington, there's this unfortunate news of the USCCB's general secretary resigning amid allegations of improper behavior. You knew Monsignor Jeffrey Burrill and just said how saddened you were by this. What was the story that unfolded? And we don't have much time, but what's unfolding there?
Yeah, well, in a nutshell, he resigned under accusations or allegations of sexual misconduct. It became a very strange story because of in the reporting of it. Apparently, he was using an app called a Grindr that one uses to find sort of indiscriminate encounters, and that data, all of the data for that, became sort of public. And it's raised a variety of issues about apps such as that. But unfortunately, it's also quite another scandal for the church here in the United States, and the USCCB in particular, especially because he was such a high-ranking and prominent member of the USCCB, and was a key figure in the task force after the McCarrick scandal, looking into sexual abuse and sexual impropriety. So it's another blow, I think, one of many that we've had here in the U.S.
Yeah, and we should clarify, it wasn't this wasn't accusations of inappropriate conduct with minors. It was adults, but exactly. Nonetheless, it's disturbing, and also, you know, as you mentioned, the methods used to find this out have been in question, the journalistic standards and whatnot. So I'm sure that conversation will continue to unfold. But I want to mention a wonderful interview, an imperative interview to read at ncregister.com about the Christian Liberation Movement leader in Cuba on the protest against the regime. It was quite a get, and I hope our readers will go and find it at ncregister.com. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio. Until next week, God bless you.